And there are new figures on the wiki. Uh-oh. Okay. Very good. Okay, so, anyway. Yesterday, we were... Good morning. Yesterday, we were heavily engaged in trying to compute the renormalization group equation for the coupling constant of Young-Mills theory. So, in the first part of the lecture, I computed for you in hopefully a completely satisfactory way the running of the electromagnetic coupling in QED and in scalar QED. And in both cases, we got a positive beta function, which means the coupling constant decreases at large distances, which made much physical sense, but it's not the answer we wanted. So then we began to analyze Young-Mills theory, and for this, a lot of heavy machinery had to be trotted out. And let me just write down the point that we got to at the end of the lecture. So I was working with a Lagrangian, which was expanded around a background field A, and F is the field strength of the background field. And then we had fields that were undergoing fluctuations in this background field, and there were all kinds of such fields. There was a fluctuation of the vector field, then that vector field had a ghost, and then I had fermions in the theory, but I'd rewritten this in such a way that the fermions, I only had half the number of fermions, because I'd squared the Dirac action. And then I also had scalars in the theory. And very nicely, the kinetic term for all of these particles was arranged to be the same. Namely, delta is minus d squared plus 2 times a half the background. This is d in the background A. This is in the background F. This thing here is the generator of angular momentum in the appropriate representation, and then the gauge charge. And incidentally, in case you're keeping score, this 2 is the Landé G factor of the particle. So all these particles have G equals 2. That's, of course, what you expect for a Dirac field. It's also true for a Young-Mills vector. Yes? And the coupling is only appearing right there. That is, I cleaned up the notation a little on the lecture notes from what I did in class. But when you do it correctly, the coupling should only appear right here. Yes? Sorry? Between the F and the T. This is a J. So J is, remember, J was I over 2 gamma mu gamma nu for a Dirac spinner. And it was I delta mu alpha delta nu beta minus delta nu alpha delta mu beta for a 4 vector, and 0 for a scalar. So it's the representation of angular momentum. It's the spin operator. And so there we go. So now, in principle, this is a totally general formalism, and we can now use it to integrate out all of the fluctuations. Yes? This is exactly the magnetic moment. It's the external field dotted into the spin.
So what causes the actual
effect? Radiative corrections.
Okay.
This is the lowest order expression.
like the Lagrangian, this is like the lowest order particle.
This is the Lagrangian.
Okay.
This is the Lagrangian. So in QED, the G factor is 2 plus, excuse me, 0.001 or something like that. And it comes from the next order diagram. It comes from when you compute the Spiny diagram.
But you use the same name for the number that you get from the experiments, which is directed, and the number that's in the Lagrangian, which is exactly the
same. Well, so the magnetic moment is the G factor times the charge times E H bar over the mass times the spin. That's the definition of the Lende G factor.
Okay,
well, so Q here is 1. I'm taking out the E. H bar is 1. The mass will come in when you do a non-relativistic reduction of this. But basically, what the G factor is the coupling of the spin to an external magnetic field. And that's what you see there. And so it turns out that this factor here is the lowest order, the Lagrangian level Lende G factor. So for the Dirac equation, that's 2. And then it gets some radiative corrections. OK? Good. OK, so now what I propose to do is just to start computing some Feynman diagrams with this action. And then we'll try and resum them appropriately as corrections to the g squared bit sphere. And the nicest place to start is with the scalar field. So let me do that. So with the scalar field, this term is not here. D squared is the usual kinetic energy term for a scalar field. And so when I start, if I write down diagrams that involve the scalar field, they'll involve the external field here and the usual scalar vertices. And so the lowest order contribution is this. It's just exactly what we wrote down last time, except that instead of having these ends free, they're integrated up with the background field, which is in D. So I remind you again, D is d mu minus ig, the a mu of the background field times t. And so, well, now we can just write down what this is. There's a symmetry factor of a half, because these two points are not distinguished from one another. Then there's an integral d4x over these background fields, which I'm going to write in momentum space. Minus q and q. Then there's the value of these diagrams, which actually we computed yesterday. So let me just write down the answer. And then there's a group theory times the log of minus q squared. And then there's a group theory factor from the t here. So there'll be the trace of TATB. And these group theory factors, I'm going to introduce just some notation, so I don't have to worry too much about computing them. I'm going to call that C of R delta AB. And eventually, we're going to run into the trace of the j's as well. So let me call that C of j times delta mu lambda g mu lambda g nu sigma minus g. It's antisymmetric, mu sigma g nu lambda. Okay. So this thing, it's got to be proportional to delta AB. So let me just write C of r delta AB. Well, very good. Now, this object here we recognize as the Fourier transform of f mu nu squared. So this is apparently 1/4 the integral d4q over 2 pi to the 4th f mu nu squared The A's, the group indices, are traced because of this delta AB. And all that's left is C of R over 48 pi squared log of minus Q squared, and that's it. Oh, and there's this I, which I'll put out here. Okay, now this is the first term in an expansion, if you like, 1 plus this plus other things. It's a perturbation, it's small, so why don't I just put it back up in the exponential? And when I put it in the exponential, this is f mu nu squared. I can add it directly to that term. So now we're doing excellently. Now, apparently, the action has turned into the following thing, 1 over 4g squared, and there's this f mu nu squared. And then, of course, there's an, maybe I should say an I always in front of the action. What's in the exponential is I times the action. So then there's this extra term that I can just add right in here, minus, there's the 1/4 already, I have to put back the g squared, 48 pi squared c of r log of minus q squared. Well, this is actually pretty neat. Now what you see is that the coefficient of the external field has acquired a momentum dependence. The momentum dependence is exactly g squared over 1 minus g squared over 48 pi squared c of r log of minus q squared. This must be the running coupling constant. And if you remember yesterday's lecture, that's exactly what we found by other methods for scalar QED. In scalar QED, the c of r would be 1. And g would be e, but otherwise the expression is identical to the one that we derived yesterday. Okay? Well, this is fabulous. Now the machine is working, so we just turn the crank, and many more results will come out. So let's now do the same computation. Maybe I should leave this on the blackboard and do it over here for the fermion field. So for the fermion field, there are three diagrams. Now, for the fermion field, maybe I should just say, if we kept it in the original form with d slash here and the full number of fermions instead of half, we could do the same computation and the same result would appear. We would get the same formula that we got yesterday in QED, plus this factor of C of R. But instead, I'd like to do the fermions in this funny notation using this D'Alembert-Schön operator. So if I do it that way, then I'll get these diagrams that I got for the scalar field. And the only change with them is that 4 Dirac degrees of freedom flow in the loop, and then I have to divide by a half. But there's one more diagram. Because if I take this guy in here, then there's this operator makes a vertex with 2 fermions. And so I'd better include that diagram as well. And that's a pretty easy integral to do. There are no derivatives on the fermions. So it's just a simple scalar integral. Yes?
What are the vertices there? It looks like you've drawn a little loops around.
That's right. That vertex is exactly what's written here. F mu nu, J mu, times I. That's the whole vertex.
Okay, so there are three loops in
that diagram? No. There's just a vertex.
Oh, it's a different kind of.
It's a different kind of vertex, and this, the gamma matrices in here act on the Dirac spin. Okay. And so, needless to say, this diagram is proportional to the trace of J mu nu J lambda sigma, in both cases dotted with F mu nu. Okay. when I trace over the fermion loop, I'll get this factor. And then I'll evaluate that using this identity here, because the trace of J is, it must be Lorentz invariant, so there's nothing else it can be but contractions of the indices. And in the end, I'll get F mu nu squared. So what we're going to get from the fermions is then the following thing, something almost identical to what's written there. 1/4 the integral d4q over 2 pi to the 4th f mu nu squared. I'm just reading from the bottom line here. Now, there's a C of R that multiplies the whole thing, because every term has this trace of TATA. Then, from the scalar integral, that's these two, I get a 1 over 48 pi squared. There's a 4 because I have 4 degrees of freedom for the Dirac field. This diagram contributes minus 4 C of J over 16 pi squared. Log minus Q squared. And now there are two more things that I need to take into account. Fermions are fermions, so I need a minus sign for the fermion loop, and I need that factor of 2. And so this thing is the value of that diagram, which you can easily ascertain using the methods that I described yesterday. Okay, well, now, what's the value of C of J? Well, C of J, you can just go and compute it. It's 0 for a scalar, because the J is 0 for a scalar. For a Dirac fermion, it's 1, and for a vector, it's 2. So if I look at this coefficient here, this is 4, it's 1/4 minus 1/12 is 1/6. 1/12, when I include the factor of 2, and then I put back the minus sign, it turns out to be exactly 1 over 12 pi squared. Yes?
I'm not sure I understand. If the 1 over 16 pi squared and 1 over 48 pi squared come from integrals, why do you still have an integral d for q?
Oh, because this is basically the integral d4x over the background field.
Okay,
so there's a, momentum q, if you like, and I have to integrate over q. That's this integral.
Okay.
So that's the d4x integral. And then there's an integral over k, and that integral I did, and that's where these factors came. And so this factor here is coming exactly from the integral. Too many things to keep track of on the blackboard. The integral d4k over 2 pi to the 4th. 1 over k plus q squared. 1 over k squared is equal to I over 16 pi squared. And then minus log is minus q squared. Or this is lambda squared over q squared. So this is an integral that we discussed yesterday. And the minus sign here comes from the fact that q is in the denominator. Okay. Good. So the whole result is 1 over 12 pi squared. And so then when we put it up here, for the fermion, we'll get minus g squared C of R over 12 pi squared times the log of minus q squared. And that's exactly the contribution to the running of the coupling constant that we got yesterday for a fermion. OK, well, now we're going. So now all we have to do is to figure out what contribution we're going to get from the remaining things, the Young-Mills field and the ghost. So if you don't mind, let me just erase these lines here. And let's see what we get. again, everything is going to sum up into this f mu nu squared. For those diagrams, the same analysis applies. The same diagrams appear. We just have to count the factors. So for the Young-Mills field, we'll get the following. I just have to be a little careful. From the first two diagrams, 1 over 48 pi squared, there are 4 degrees of freedom in a vector field, minus 4, C of j is 2 over 16 pi squared. There's a half because a vector field is a real, not a complex degree of freedom. So again, there are half the number of degrees of freedom. And then there's this log of minus q squared. Oh, and there's one more factor. The C of r is now a factor C of g, which is the this object taken in the adjoint representation, the representation that the vectors live in. And then the ghosts only give the scalar diagrams. So there's one ghost. It comes with a minus sign because it's a fermion. It also comes with a C of G and a log of minus Q squared. And so those factors also go into this expression. And so let me just put them in there. So there'll be a minus a C of G, a log of minus Q squared, and then we just have to get all these factors. So please notice that both of the coefficients here are negative. This one here is 1/2 and 1/12. Sorry, it's a half minus a 12th, so it's 5/12 or 10/24. And the ghost contributes 1/24. Okay, and g squared is in the other cases because we borrowed the g squared from here. Okay, well, now we're doing truly excellently. So now I can just write down the beta function for Young-Mills theory. Beta of g is equal to for the fermions, plus g cubed over 12 pi squared times C of r times the number of fermions. For the bosons, g cubed over 48 pi squared times C of r times the number of bosons. And for the Young-Mills fields, we add up all this stuff. And it's not a plus sign, it's a minus sign. 11 over 24 pi squared. No, that's not right. Oh, sorry. Please excuse me. I neglected the half here. So this should have been... what have I done? I made a couple mistakes. First of all, I neglected the half, so this should have been 10 over 48. And secondly, I just miscopied. Okay. So 11 over 48 pi squared times C of g times nothing. And very interestingly, the answer is negative for the contribution of the Young-Mills field. So the way this is usually written is that this is g cubed over 4 pi squared, 11/3 C of g minus Sorry? Yes. Minus 4/3 C of R times the number of fermions. I'll leave off the bosons now because they were just auxiliary. And so that's the beta function of Young-Mills theory. And please notice that it is negative, at least when C of G is sufficiently larger than NF. And this is the famous discovery of Tuft, Gross, Politzer, and Wilczek, that in Young-Mills theory, at least in pure Young-Mills theory, the coupling constant is weak in the ultraviolet, and it's strong in the infrared. So just to make this slightly more concrete, if we choose the group SUN, then C of G, you can evaluate it, it's N. If I choose the fundamental representation, the n-dimensional representation of SUN, C of R is a half. And then you get this formula that the beta function is minus g cubed over 4 pi squared times 11/3 n minus 2/3 nf. And that's a formula you'll see, a famous formula that you'll see in many places. So if n is, something and nf is not too large, then Young-Mills theory has this property that we were looking for yesterday, which is called asymptotic freedom. The property that it's strong in the infrared and weak in the ultraviolet. Okay? So please excuse me the heavy formal labor, but this is the most important formula in the strong interaction, so we'd better actually understand where it comes from. Okay, maybe I should just say, in my book, there's another derivation of this equation, which is pure plug and chug. And so if you don't believe this, you can go do it that way, and you'll see you get the same answer. Yes?
Factor NF, that's the number of fermions in theory, or in what?
It's the number of fermions that would be in these loops. So it's the number of fermions that would couple to the coupling constant for Young-Mills. Now, as we discussed yesterday for QED, I'm computing all the loops in the limit where the momentum transferred by the photon or gluon field is much larger than the mass of the fermion. So heavy fermions drop out, but light fermions contribute. Actually, maybe we'll get to that point right now. Okay. So now, this is really interesting. What makes it more interesting is that you can survey other renormalizable quantum field theories in four dimensions. There are not so many of them. Tony Z, the author of one of your quantum field theory books, actually computed the beta functions in 1973, before this result was known. Tony Z computed the beta function in just about every quantum field theory that didn't involve Young-Mills gauge bosons, and it turned out they were all positive. So this is actually the only way to get a negative beta function among renormalizable theories in four dimensions. So we're stuck with this as a theory of strong interactions. If we want this property of asymptotic freedom, we'd really better go this route. And actually, we're with a unique theory. Because of this idea that, now the question is, what is this Young-Mills theory coupled to? And the obvious thing to say is that the Young-Mills theory should couple to that mysterious degree of freedom called color that quarks have. Quarks have this extra threefold degree of freedom, red, blue, and green, that always has to be in a singlet state. And the natural thing to do is to say that's what the Young-Mills gauge symmetry should couple to. It should have the quarks in a three-dimensional representation of its gauge group. Now, there aren't too many Lie groups with three-dimensional representations. It's pretty much SU3 and O3, the rotation group in three dimensions. If we want the singlets to be 3, 3 bar and 3, 3, 3, but not 3 plus 3. That is, we don't have any diquark mesons. Then the only choice is SU3. So now, actually, we have a unique theory of strong interactions. So the theory is a Yang-Mills theory. Quarks are Dirac fermions in the three-dimensional representation of the group SU3. And I can even write down the Lagrangian. There's only one choice, plus the sum over flavors of q bar I d slash minus mf q. We'll have to talk about where the masses come from later. We will. OK, there it is. That's the unique renormalizable Lagrangian that satisfies the principles I've been talking about. And the name of this theory is quantum chromodynamics. Or QCD. Yes?
Did you say that it was something about not wanting diquark mesons?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So if I had SO3 as the group, then delta IJ would be an invariant. So then I could have gauge singlet states that had two quarks in them. Right. And these things don't exist. They would be fractionally charged. We know they don't exist. So this is ruled out. And the other possibility is SU3. Yes?
What other ideas exist because you know they don't exist because you haven't seen
them? Well, no, we know they don't exist because we haven't seen them. But we'd obviously see them because this is a fractionally charged state. OK. So now, I guess the next thing to do is tell you all about the properties of QCD. And there are, oh, please.
About the general form of the beta function we derive for Yang-Mills theories.
Yes.
Isn't QED technically Yang-Mills theory just with the group U1?
Right.
So is there any way to see how this reduces to the normal QED beta function?
Yes, in Q, so C of G, I didn't write you a very explicit formula for C of G. But I wrote some formulae from which you could deduce that. Let me make it a little more explicit. So first I wrote the matrix, the group matrix in the adjoint representation was I FABC. So I claimed that these matrices viewed in this way satisfied the commutation relations of the Lie algebra. Then I wrote that C of G delta AB is the trace of two of those matrices. So let me write this out explicitly. This is minus F C A D F D B C. So to put it another way, F is totally antisymmetric. F A C D F B C D. So C of G is basically the square of the structure constants of the group. Now, for an abelian group, everything commutes. F is 0, so C of G is 0. So if I set C of G equal to 0 here, I go back to the QED result.
So essentially, you say
that it's 0 for 1. Whether it's 0 or 1, you can quarrel. But C of G is definitely 0. OK? So the group has to be non-abelian. The non-abelian nature is essential. In the lecture notes, there's a little bit about that at the end of the lecture. You guys can look at it. I don't have time to discuss it. OK. So now we can look at QCD in various regimes. First of all, the low-energy regime, where it's strongly coupled. Secondly, the high-energy regime, where it's weakly coupled. I'd just like to say a few words about the low-energy regime. Obviously, when the theory is strongly coupled, it's going to be hard for us to do precise calculations about what the theory predicts in that regime. However, for QCD, there's a quite unique method, which gives you actually a lot of information. It turns out that you can write a non-abelian gauge theory on a lattice space-time. So you discretize space-time. And then there's a representation of Young-Mills theory, which is locally gauge invariant in that structure. This was invented by Wilson and Polyakov. In that theory, it's possible to make an expansion about strong coupling. That is an expansion about the limit g goes to infinity. The expansion is very beautiful. If I had another week in the course, I would tell you all about it, but I don't. So let me just say that the property of that expansion is that only states that are gauge singlets have finite energy. So in the strong coupling limit of this lattice version of QCD, it is actually manifest that the only states of finite energy are those which are singlets of the gauge group. And so that then tells us exactly what we want to know. The states of quarks that have finite energy are the mesons and baryons. And states where I try and pull the quarks out, it turns out literally in this expansion, you can see that a string will come and join the quark that was kicked out to its partners, the color neutralizer. So the strong coupling expansion, only possible on a space-time lattice, but nevertheless, qualitatively, it gives the right picture. This lattice gauge theory, it turns out, is amenable to numerical computations, rather heavy numerical computations. But nevertheless, you can numerically derive the spectrum of the lattice gauge theory and then try and take the limit numerically where the lattice becomes very fine. And you go back to the continuum limit. People have been working on that for the past almost 30 years. There's been a lot of progress. And right now, it seems pretty clear that the meson and baryon spectrum that you get in those studies is within a few percent of what you see in the particle data book for the low-lying states. So the direct computation of hadron masses in lattice gauge theory seems to confirm what we see in the real world. OK, I'm going to turn my attention in another direction, because it's just more amenable to things we can do on the blackboard. Namely, I want to go to high energy, where the QCD coupling becomes weak. And I want to ask, can we actually see the predictions of Young-Mills theory in that limit? Maybe we ought to figure out what the predictions of Young-Mills theory are in that limit, and then we'll see if they actually agree with experiment. So what I'd like to do then is to consider high energy. And in general, I'd like to now consider energies that are sufficiently high that, I think most of the results I'm going to show you are for momentum transfers that are something like between 10 GeV and something like 100 GeV. Actually, in principle, you could go up higher. This is 200 GeV, I guess, is the highest one's been in E plus E minus. We've been higher in hadron collisions. I'll tell you about that tomorrow. Now, when we're above 10 GeV, five of the quarks, U, D, S, C, and B, are all massless. And then we have a rather simple formula for the running of the coupling constant. Let me write it in terms of the parameter alpha S, which is G squared over 4 pi. So I'm just going to write the formula that I wrote for you before with factors of 4 pi sucked into it. So alpha s of q is equal to alpha s at some reference scale q0 divided by 1 plus alpha s of q0 divided by 2 pi. There's a coefficient here, b0, and then the log of q over q0. And b0 is 11 thirds times 3 minus 2 thirds times the number of quarks, which here will be 5. That is to say, 5 quarks, to answer the previous question, 5 quarks much lighter in mass than the momentum transfer that I'm talking about. And so this number is 23 thirds. And so then I would just put that into here, and then I would get a prediction for the dependence of alpha s on the momentum transfer scale as a function of that scale. And it's a logarithmic dependence, so I have to get a substantial moment arm in Q in order to see an effect. But nevertheless, over a range of Q, there's an effect. So for example, at 10 GeV, this number, I need to measure alpha S at some point. So with the current best value of alpha S, this would be something like 0.18 at 10 GeV, and it would be something like 0.12 at 100 GeV. So that gives you an idea of the magnitude of this quantity alpha S. It's not 1 over 137, but it's 1 over 8 or 9. It's a small parameter, and we can use it to do perturbation theory. And maybe I should also say, when Q becomes very small, I'll get a negative sign here. This will blow up. And the place where this formula blows up is somewhere around 200 MeV. So it blows up way down in the region where you have the hadron spectrum. Okay. Now, in this high energy regime, there's an obvious question to ask. Namely, this is a theory of fermions and vector bosons. So can we actually tell whether the vector boson is there? So how can we do that? Well, one way is to try and radiate the vector bosons. So let's go back to our relatively simple process of E plus E minus annihilation to hadrons. And there we have this lowest order diagram, E plus E minus to QQ bar. There are certainly higher order diagrams that involve photon emission, so there must be higher order diagrams that involve gluon emission. And so at order alpha S, we'll encounter this process. Yes?
I don't get that stuff where you say that because there are diagrams that emit photons, we must have.
It's just an analogy.
This
is a diagram. These are diagrams in the theory.
Okay.
And they correspond to the emission of a gluon, that is the Young-Mills gauge boson from Q and Q. Okay? And we'll do some laborious computations in a moment, but let me spare you this one. Let me just set up the kinematics a little, and then I'll write down the answer. It's not a hard computation. You guys have all studied three-body phase space?
Yeah.
Nod your heads if you have. So let's write, let's call these K1, K2, and K3. Q is K1 plus K2 plus K3. Xi is Q dot Ki over Q squared. So this is equal to the fraction of the maximum momentum that each quark or a gluon can have. X1 plus X2 plus X3 is 1. I'm ignoring the masses of everything. So this is the simplest case of three-body phase space. Let sigma 0 be this cross-section, 4 pi over 3 alpha squared over S times the 3qf squared, the factor for the quark charges and colors. And then with a couple pieces of paper, you can do this cross-section. And here's the answer. Sigma 0, there's got to be a factor of alpha s. It turns out 2 alpha s over 3 pi, x1 squared plus x2 squared over 1 minus x1, 1 minus x2. There are singularities. We're going to discuss those singularities in gory detail in just a minute. This number here is the 10th 2 times that number, 5%. There's a singularity here that blows it up. So depending on how you measure the gluonic emission property of the state, which we'll get to in a moment, 10 to 20% of the events should have gluon emission. So on page 2 of the figures, you will see Maybe this is the same event I showed you before, or maybe another one. They all look the same. A two-jet event measured by the SLD. And now if you turn the page, you will see a three-jet event measured by the SLD. So this would presumably have three partons in it. And the third one would probably be this radiated gluon. And then if you turn the page again, you'll see a four-jet event measured by SLD, which would correspond to double gluon radiation. So these events are there, and now the question is, are they there at the correct rate? Now, there's some subtlety, because in order to ask whether they're at the correct rate, we should try and define some precise way of knowing, is an event two-jet-like, or is it three-jet-like, or it maybe more jet-like? So how do we actually go about measuring that? Similarly, if I want to turn this cross-section into a rate, I have to integrate over x1 and x2 in some way so that I get a number. I probably better avoid the singularities when x1 goes to 1 or x2 goes to 1. So what's a good way to do that? So needless to say, there's a huge literature on how you quantify the shapes of events in E plus E minus. I'd like to give you just one observable that turns out to be a pretty good one for a number of reasons. And that observable is called the thrust. It was invented by Ed Fahey. And here's the definition. What I want to do is to take my actual particles in the final state, and I want to try and find the best axis on which these particles line up. And having done that, I'm going to construct the sum over the particles of n dot p, the absolute value, divided by the sum of the momentum. And I'm going to maximize this over n. And the basic idea here is that if, as the quarks develop into hadrons, they're not exchanging large momenta among themselves and throwing each other out at large angles, then the thrust that's created at the quark and gluon level is going to be equal to the thrust that I have at the hadron level. So I can actually measure this in a particle experiment and then compare it to a thrust calculation in a framework like this. So the next thing we should do, I guess, is to calculate the thrust from this formula. And frankly, it's pretty simple. We just apply this method exactly to the kinematics that are given here. So a three-jet event, I can always put the three particles in a plane because their momentum, their three momentum must sum to zero. So here's 1, 2, and 3. And x1 and x2 and x3 are all summed to 2. They're all between 1 and minus 1. So if I want to calculate the thrust of this configuration, all I have to do is line up n with one of these vectors. And maybe I should say the right solution is to line up n with the longest of those vectors. So for my QQ bar glue state, the thrust is equal to the maximum of the three quantities, x1, x2, and x3. Namely, if I line up n with x1, then I get a term here, which is x1 times the maximum energy. Then n dot 2 plus n dot 3 must be exactly opposite that. And I'm taking the absolute value. And then you divide by the total energy. And so we'll get that. Good. So now I'm all set. Oh, by the way, you can see that the thrust in a three gluon configuration is always between 1 2/3. Because the lowest possible value of thrust is where I have what's called a Mercedes configuration, where the three vectors are equal. And then each one will have length 2/3. You can also see that if I have a random orientation, of tracks that is something like this in three dimensions, then the thrust will be a third. So the fact that the thrust is near one is my indication that I'm mainly in two jet events. The deviation of the thrust from one measures the fraction of three jet events. And now I can just take that formula and integrate it over x1 and x2, keeping this constant. Once again, I'll spare you the labor here. The answer is d sigma dt, so this is the thrust distribution. It's proportional to alpha s. If you're really interested in particle physics, you may want to derive these formulae. It's a relatively simple integration. If you're not, well, I won't make you. Okay, so that's the explicit formula. If you plot it out on your Mathematica, it will turn out to be something that looks like this. It's got a singularity, obviously, when t goes to 1. Oh, I'm plotting this against 1 minus t, which is convenient. It's got a singularity when t goes to 1, which is 0 in this plot. It must go to 0 at 1/3, and so it'll have some shape like that. Now, usually people don't compare this to experiment. And the reason is because there are some things that are obviously wrong with this diagram. First of all, if I have some particles, they never all line up in a line. So as soon as I make hadrons, there'll be some rounding off of the singularity near t equals 1. So a real thrust distribution will actually look something like that. And further, as soon as I emit the fourth jet, I'll be able to go into this region, and so there'll be a little tail down here as well. So if you take those effects into account, what you actually expect a thrust distribution to look like is something like that. And people make explicit models of how the quarks turn into gluons to try and get a good fit in these two regions. But in the central region, between the thrust 1 minus t of about 0.05 and 0.3, it's basically the QCD prediction. So without warning, you can now turn the page, and what you see is a comparison of the thrust distribution measured by SLD to experiment. And you see that it works pretty well. The normalization in this region is proportional to alpha s, and so from that we can get a determination of alpha s at a given energy. As the momentum transfer becomes larger, alpha s decreases, so the thrust distribution sloughs down. The thrust goes to 1, or 1 minus t is going to slough down towards 0, and so this distribution will become steeper and steeper. And from that, we can measure the evolution of alpha s. This is one of a number of quantitative variables one uses to discuss event shapes. And so from those, you get measurements of alpha s at different energies that E plus E minus colliders have run. So if you turn the page again, you'll see what the data is. And actually, it's incredibly beautiful. So the red points on this curve are determinations of alpha s from this technique. And quite amazingly, they follow exactly the formula for the running of the coupling constant that we just wrote down on the blackboard, with the coefficients which are appropriate to QCD. So pretty cool. The different colored points are different determinations of alpha s, some of which we will and some of which we will not talk about in this course. Okay. Now, at this moment, I must ask Callum, whether I may have another 10 minutes. You think I should stop?
10 minutes yesterday, it's about 10 minutes in the morning.
How about really 10 minutes? I didn't start until 10 after. There's one more calculation I'd like to do. Okay. We'll take a vote. Who would like to know what these singularities are about today, and who is perfectly content to wait until tomorrow? Okay, today. Tomorrow. I think the tomorrows have it. Okay. Very good.
Okay.